Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving into a really significant work, Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone. It's a book that honestly changed how a lot of people thought about American society.
It really did. It's this huge diagnosis, you could say, of this feeling many of us have.
Yeah.
You know, that despite being more connected technologically, we somehow feel more disconnected.
Right. And Putnam gives it a name, or at least quantifies the decline of something vital. He calls it social capital. Mm-hmm. Let's define that first, because capital makes you think money or buildings, but social capital, what is that exactly?
Think of it like this. It's the value we get from our social networks.
Mm.
You know, the trust, the norms, the feeling that we're kind of in it together.
Yeah.
It helps society function smoothly. It's not the people, but the links between them.
Okay, got it. Which leads straight to that title, Bowling Alone. It's such a great image.
It really is.
Yeah.
He points out this paradox. More Americans were actually bowling than ever back when he wrote it, but fewer and fewer were joining leagues.
And that's the whole story in miniature, isn't it?
Exactly. It's that shift from a shared, regular, you know, communal thing where you have teammates, you show up, you build relationships, to just doing it on your own whenever. It's a move from we to me.
And, okay, bowling leagues, maybe that sounds trivial, but Putnam's argument is that this isn't trivial. This erosion of connection impacts, well, pretty much everything.
Everything. How well our local government works, how safe our neighborhoods feel, our economy even, believe it or not, our personal health and happiness. It's foundational.
So who is the person who put all this together? Let's talk about Robert Putnam himself.
Yeah. Robert David Putnam. He's a major figure, professor of public policy at Harvard, a really distinguished political scientist, decades of serious data-heavy research.
He's not just offering opinions then. This is built on evidence.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And Bowling Alone wasn't his first big splash either. He'd already written Making Democracy Work back in 93.
The Italy study. Right. I remember that.
That's the one. He studied regional governments in Italy for, like, decades.
Mm.
And he found this incredibly clear link. The regions that worked best, that were most effective, they were the ones with deep roots in what he called civic traditions. You know, singing societies, sports clubs, mutual aid groups. Basically, high social capital.
So he showed empirically, like with numbers, that strong community ties lead to better government.
Precisely. Established that social capital wasn't just some fuzzy feel-good concept. It had measurable, real-world consequences for governance.
So when he turned his attention to the U.S. with Bowling Alone, he already had this powerful framework. He wasn't just guessing. He was applying a tested theory.
Exactly. He's like a social detective, really. Digging through stacks and stacks of data surveys, membership lists, time use diaries, looking for patterns nobody else had quite pieced together in the same way.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself, Bowling Alone. What's the big picture?
Well, it's this sweeping look at American life, focusing mainly on the period from about, say, 1965 to 2000. He argues this was a time of really dramatic change, a kind of turning point.
And the core mission of the book is basically to document and explain a huge decline, right? A decline in Americans participating in, well, almost everything social.
Yeah, that's the heart of it. It's not just a feeling. He brings the receipts, so to speak.
Mm.
He shows, with data, this widespread withdrawal from community life.
And the evidence is pretty overwhelming, isn't it? It's not just one type of data.
No, it's incredibly broad. Membership numbers from, like, PTAs, the Rotary Club, unions, veterans groups, church groups, you name it. Then there's decades of polling on whether people trust each other.
Time use surveys, too, right? Like, how people actually spend their evening.
Mm-hmm. Volunteer hours, political participation, even informal stuff like having friends over for dinner or playing cards. Across the board, the trend lines mostly point downwards.
And the stakes, as he frames it, are really high. This isn't just about losing some social niceties.
Not at all. He argues that social capital is as vital for a healthy society as, say, financial capital or human capital. You know, education and skills are for the economy. It's essential infrastructure, just invisible.
Okay, let's dig into that evidence a bit more. Part two of the book lays out the decline in formal civic life.
Right. This is where you see the numbers for those traditional organizations just plummeting. Groups that used to be the backbone of community life.
Like the PTA you mentioned. A League of Women Voters, unions, fraternal organizations like the Elks or the Masons.
Exactly. These were places where people from different walks of life actually met, worked on projects together, built trust. But membership and, crucially, active participation in these groups peaked around the mid-60s and then just fell off a cliff for decades.
And it's not just that the clubs got smaller, it's that the functions they performed started to disappear too, right?
Yeah, that's a key point. Who organizes the town festival? Who runs the charity drive? Who shows up to the school board meeting? When these groups weaken, the collective action they enabled often just stops happening.
But it wasn't only the formal memberships, was it? He also talks about our personal lives, our informal connections.
Yeah, that's another big piece. He documents how Americans started, you know, socializing less informally. Fewer dinner parties, fewer card games, less just like dropping by a neighbor's place.
Hanging out.
Basically, yeah. And all this connects to maybe the most worrying trend he tracks, the decline in social trust.
Yeah. The percentage of people who say most people can be trusted, that really dropped, didn't it?
Dramatically. And that's huge because trust is like the lubricant for social capital. If you don't trust the people around you, cooperation becomes really, really difficult.
Everything becomes harder, from agreeing on local taxes to just feeling safe in your own neighborhood. A low trust society is, well, it's struggling.
It really is. So the big question then becomes, why? Why did this happen? And seemingly so fast. This is where part three comes in, where Putnam sort of investigates the suspects.
And he knocks down some of the usual suspects, right? Like people just being too busy.
Yeah, he looks at things like pressures from two-career families, longer commutes, people moving more often, urban sprawl, and finds they do play a role, but only a surprisingly small one, maybe like 10% each, something like that.
So they're part of the story, but not the main drivers.
Right. They don't explain the sheer scale of the decline.
So if it wasn't just being busy or moving around, what was the main culprit or culprits?
Well, Putnam identifies two really big ones. The first one, electronic entertainment, specifically television.
Ah, TV. The great time suck.
Pretty much. His argument is pretty straightforward. TV watching privatized our leisure time. Instead of going out to a meeting or a game, people stayed in. It turned leisure from something active and shared into something passive and solitary.
And you don't really build social capital sitting alone watching a screen.
Nope. And the impact he measured was staggering. He famously calculated that the effect of heavy TV watching on your social connectedness was, and I'm quoting roughly here, comparable to the effect of belonging to a different social class.
Wow, that's massive. So how much TV you watch is as big a factor in your social life as your entire socioeconomic status.
That's what his data suggested. It basically rewired how millions of people spent their free time almost overnight, pulling them away from community engagement.
Okay, so TV is a major villain in this story, but you said there were two big factors.
Yes, and the second one, according to Putnam, might be even bigger, accounting for maybe up to half of the total decline. And that's generational change.
Generational change, meaning different generations behave differently.
Exactly. He identifies what he calls the long civic generation. These are folks born roughly between 1910 and 1940.
Okay, the generation that lived through the Depression and World War II.
Right. And his argument is that experiencing those huge shared national crises forged an exceptionally strong sense of community and civic duty in that generation. They were just unusually engaged. They built and led many of those organizations we talked about.
They were joiners, basically.
Very much so. But here's the crucial part. As that highly civic generation began to age and pass away, the generations that followed them, the baby boomers, Gen X, simply didn't participate at the same levels, even when they reached the same age.
So the civic habits weren't passed down or weren't picked up to the same degree?
It seems not. Subsequent generations grew up in different circumstances, maybe more affluence, more individualism, definitely more television. And the result was, on average, less engagement in traditional civic life.
That sounds kind of deterministic, like civic virtue just faded out with a generation.
Well, he doesn't present it as completely inevitable, but the demographic data is pretty stark. The replacement of that highly engaged generation by less engaged cohorts is a major engine driving the overall decline he documented. It's a slow motion effect.
Okay, let's go back a bit and look at the core themes. The first one seems clear. Social capital isn't just nice, it's essential.
Absolutely. It underlines that our own success and well-being are tied up with the health of our community. You can't really thrive long term if the social fabric around you is fraying.
And that leads to another key idea he introduced, a really important distinction, the difference between bonding and bridging social capital.
Yes, crucial difference. Bonding capital is about connections within a group of similar people. Think of, like, a close-knit ethnic association or maybe a bowling team where everyone's already friends. It reinforces us.
Okay, inward-looking. So what's bridging?
Bridging capital connects people across different groups. It links people who are unlike, different ages, races, economic backgrounds, political views. Think of maybe a community choir or a neighborhood improvement project that brings diverse residents together. It builds way.
And why is that distinction so important?
Well, bonding capital gives you support, like-minded community. But bridging capital is what's really vital for a diverse democracy to function. It builds broader trust, tolerance, the ability to cooperate with people who aren't like you.
Right. If everyone just sticks to their own group, society gets fragmented.
Exactly. You need those bridges.
Okay. Theme three. This stuff has real, tangible outcomes.
Totally. This isn't just theory. Putnam shows that communities with higher social capital consistently do better on measurable things. Schools perform better, crime rates are lower, economies grow faster, people are literally healthier and report being happier.
So getting involved isn't just civic duty, it's actually an investment in a better life for everyone, including yourself.
That's the takeaway. It has concrete benefits.
And the final theme. Despite this pretty sobering diagnosis of decline, there's a note of hope, right?
Yes, definitely. He points back to history, specifically the Progressive Era in the late 19th, early 20th century.
A time of huge upheaval, industrialization, immigration.
Right. And back then, Americans faced similar challenges of social fragmentation. But they didn't just give up. They actively invented new forms of social capital, things like public libraries, settlement houses, new civic organizations to cope and rebuild community.
So the message is, we've been here before, and we found ways to adapt and reconnect. It's not a lost cause.
Exactly. It emphasizes that we have agency. We can choose to rebuild.
Let's share a few key lines or ideas from the book that really stick. That core metaphor is just so powerful.
More Americans are bowling than ever before, but they're not bowling in leagues. It just perfectly captures that shift from communal to individual activity. Simple, visual, profound.
Yeah. And then there's the straightforward conclusion from all the complex data.
Mm-hmm. We need to reconnect with one another. That is the simple argument of this book. After pages and pages of charts and stats, it boils down to that fundamental human need.
There's also that sense of urgency, that warning.
Right. The idea that civic engagement wasn't just fading slowly. It reversed, and we were overtaken by a treacherous rip current. That language really conveys the speed and the danger of the change, he observed.
And finally, the positive case for why we should care.
Yes. Social capital makes us smarter, healthier, safer, richer, and better able to govern a just society. A concise list of pretty compelling benefits, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. So how do we translate this into action today? What are the real-life applications?
Well, on a personal level, it's pretty direct. Prioritize actual face-to-face interaction over passive screen time. Easier said than done, I know, but join groups that require you to show up and participate, not just write a check. Maybe start something yourself, even small, a regular coffee meetup, a neighborhood potluck, a book club.
Make the effort to connect actively.
Right. And then, thinking bigger, at the community and policy level. Leaders should really focus on creating what are sometimes called third places. You know, places that aren't home, aren't work, where people can just gather informally. Parks, libraries, public squares, community centers, places that foster chance encounters and conversations.
And policymakers, they have a role too.
Definitely. Think about urban design. Does it encourage walking and meeting neighbors, or does it isolate people in cars and subdivisions? We should be asking about the social capital impact of policies. Does this new development help connect people or push them further apart?
That's a great point. Running policies through that filter.
Mm-hmm.
So, final takeaways. What really struck you or surprised you looking back at this work?
For me, it's probably the sheer weight he gives to generational replacement in television. It makes the problem feel quite deep-seated. You know, it's not just about tweaking a few programs. It's about fundamental shifts in how we live and what we value.
Yeah, it suggests reversing the trend requires a really conscious, long-term effort, especially around cultivating civic habits in younger generations.
Exactly. It's not inevitable, but it won't fix itself either.
And maybe a final thought for our listeners to chew on. Putnam wrote this mostly before the internet and social media truly exploded.
Right. That adds a whole new layer. These tools can connect us.
But how are they connecting us? That's the question, isn't it? Are we using them mainly for that bonding capital, reinforcing our existing groups, our echo chambers? Or can we figure out how to use them to build more bridging capital?
That's the challenge, I think. How do we leverage these powerful new tools to genuinely connect diverse people, build understanding across divides, and actually strengthen the broader social fabric for the 21st century instead of accidentally weakening it further.
A really crucial question for right now.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.